Well, good morning. It's always a pleasure to be back. If we could take our Bibles and open them to the book of Isaiah 33, verse 22. Well, as you guys know, I had a chance to contribute to a book, and the book basically is about this quote from Thomas Jefferson. He warned that the judiciary could become a mere thing of wax in the hands of the judiciary, which they may twist and shape into any form they please. Does this sound like something like that is going on today? So the book is basically a documentation of how that scenario has come about. And what I want to share with you this morning is really the contents of chapter 2 of the book, called Separation of Church and State, The Big Lie. And if you have a handout, hopefully you got a handout, these are the 9 simple points I'm going to make in our 2 sessions this morning. We'll probably get through half of these, maybe up to point 5 in the first hour, and then we'll take a look at the remaining points in the last hour. But this handout will really help you keep tracking with me, because we're going to be talking about a lot about the legal system and the law. In fact, I'm convinced that by the time we finish today, you're going to know more about this issue than most attorneys know about it. And the reason is because this issue is not handled in law school very well at all. In fact, a lot of these things I'm going to share with you, I had to learn after law school. So what we see happening today in our country is what I like to call a militant secularization. Society is being heavily secularized. I remember when I was a very young Christian, about 1983, I got saved and I went to my high school principal and I said, I want to start a Bible club or a Bible study here in the high school. And of course he said, "What? You can't do that. Haven't you heard about the strict wall of separation between church and state? What kind of ignoramus are you?" was sort of his attitude. So when that happened to me in 1984, that's when I began to get really interested in this whole concept of the separation of church and state. And I believe that it's this single phrase has been used in almost a satanic fashion to push America away from its Judeo-Christian heritage and into a secularized society. And this secularism is happening all around us. You might remember about a year or so ago, a high school coach was actually held in criminal contempt charges. And what was his crime? Well, he decided to pray at a high school athletic event. Manger scenes cannot be posted on the steps of the city hall. Scientific creationism cannot be taught alongside evolution. The Ten Commandments cannot be posted on a schoolhouse wall. Teacher-led prayer and Bible reading is something that is unconstitutional. And the explanation that's always given is this strict wall of separation between church and state. Now, one of the things I just want to start off with here is that if people meant by separation of church and state the following, I would be in agreement with them. Basically, the church and the state are two different realms. They have two different functions. You even see this in the Bible. God has given the state a function to restrain evil, and then he has given the church a function to fulfill the Great Commission. So they are, in essence, two different realms. But that is not how the phrase is used today. The way this phrase, separation between church and state, is used is to ban completely the Christian worldview from public life. In other words, if you have a biblical orientation, you can have absolutely no say in how public life or the state is to function. And when did this concept begin? Well, it began in 1962 and 1963 with 2 Supreme Court cases. I'm going to be referring to these Supreme Court cases quite frequently. The first one is called Engle versus Vital, 1962. And that case involved a New York school district that was having its students offer a non-compulsory voluntary prayer. The students could opt out of the prayer if they so chose to do that. The prayer was very short. It was about 22 words. It was non-denominational. And it took about 10 seconds to utter. And this was the prayer. It says, Almighty God, we acknowledge our dependence upon Thee. We beg Thy blessings upon us, our parents, our teachers, and our country. Sounds like pretty dangerous stuff, doesn't it? And so in Engle versus Vital, the first time in American history something happened, the court used a phrase called the separation of church and state to make that prayer illegal or unconstitutional. A second case arose the following year in 1963 called Abington Township versus Shemp, and this dealt with a voluntary idea where a student would stand up and read something from the Bible before the classroom. The student could pick any version of his or her choice. There was no sermons preached. There was no commentary given. Again, the activity was completely voluntary. And once again, the court used in 1963 this expression, separation of church and state, to ban that practice. And beginning with those two decisions in 1962 and 1963, courts have subsequently used that expression, separation of church and state, to remove America from its Christian heritage. You know, my mother tells me that when she grew up in public school, the teacher would read something out of the Psalms to the kids every morning. And I told her that is about as far from my reality as you could possibly get. Because by the time I started going through school, that practice had long been banned. And so what I want to show you is really this morning in our two sessions how this phrase, separation of church and state, has come into existence. How is it that it has wound its way into the fabric of our society? And as I go through this, what you're going to see is how skillfully, I believe, the adversary has worked in twisting words and manipulating concepts to get this idea into our culture to secularize society. So that's what that 9-point handout is designed to lead us through. And we're going to be doing that in our two sessions. So reason number one. The first reason why this phrase, separation of church and state, is really out of harmony with the intent of our founding fathers. Number one. And here, by the way, the 9 points we're going to walk through. There's just a quick overview of them. But the first point is this. When the court made this decision to bring separation of church and state language into our country, into our Constitution, number one, the court read words into the First Amendment that simply are not there. And the interesting thing about the First Amendment is the phrase separation of church and state never appears. Now, the Engle Court and the Shemp Courts, those 1962 and 1963 courts based their rulings on a supposed strict wall between church and state, a strict separation between church and state, supposedly found in the First Amendment. And yet, if you look at the First Amendment, you don't find the phrase separation of church and state at all. The First Amendment just says this, Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. So in the First Amendment, what you see are two clauses. The first clause is what we call the Establishment Clause, and it basically says Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. Now, what does that first clause mean? Well, what it means is our government did not want a theocracy. It's not like the Middle East or in Islam where there's no distinction between separation of church and state at all. Under Sharia law, the state is the church and the church is the state. Now, obviously, our founding fathers weren't interested in that kind of idea at all. In fact, the idea of two kingdoms is very clear even in the Old Testament. You'll notice that the kings came from the tribe of Judah. The priests came from the tribe of Levi. So there is a separation of kingdoms, even in the Old Testament and certainly into the New Testament. And that's all that the founding fathers meant through that establishment clause. They were also uninterested in a country that was based on a denomination. They didn't want the United States of America to be a Presbyterian country or a Baptist country or an Episcopalian country or something of that nature. Now, the second clause is what we call the free exercise clause. And the free exercise clause says, nor prohibiting the free exercise thereof. In other words, the founding fathers didn't want the state to govern what the church was doing. And that's basically what they meant by that phrase and these two phrases. And yet, what you don't find in the First Amendment is anything related to a strict wall of separation between church and state. If you read the First Amendment, you don't see the word strict. You don't see the word wall. You don't see the word separation. You don't see the word church. And you don't see the word state. Other than that, I guess you're pretty close, right? Now, it's very interesting that when you go into the Constitution of the former Soviet Union, this is Article 124 of the Constitution of the former Soviet Union, you do find the clause separation between church and state. It says, in order to ensure the citizens' freedom of conscience, the church in the USSR is separated from the state and the school from the church. So in atheistic countries, the phrase separation of church and state is very boldly declared. In fact, one jurist commented on this in 1958. One jurist said, much has been written in recent years concerning Thomas Jefferson's reference in 1802 to a wall of separation between church and state. It has received so much attention that one would almost think that at times it is to be found somewhere in the Constitution. So this phrase, separation between church and state, has been repeated so many times that most people believe it's actually part of the First Amendment. Most attorneys, if you ask them, believe that this phrase is found in the First Amendment. Yet it does not come from the First Amendment. So when or where or what source did the court use to develop this separation between church and state doctrine? It comes from a letter written by Thomas Jefferson to the Danbury Baptist Association in 1802. The Supreme Court, when they wanted to build a doctrine of separation between church and state, quoted Thomas Jefferson's 1802 letter. Now, it's very strange that they would quote this letter for a lot of reasons. Number one, that letter was written more than a decade after the Constitution was accepted. Number two, did you know that Thomas Jefferson wasn't even present at the Constitutional Convention? He was an ambassador in France at the time. So Thomas Jefferson says this, one passage in the paper you enclosed to me must be corrected. It is the following, and I'll say it was yourself more than any other individual that planned and established, i.e. the Constitution. I was in Europe when the Constitution was planned and never saw it until after it was established. So it's very strange that the court would grab a phrase from Thomas Jefferson to explain the original intent of the First Amendment when Thomas Jefferson was not even present at the signing of the Constitution. In fact, that letter comes a full decade after the Constitution was accepted. And the very first time this phrase ever was used in American jurisprudence, this Jeffersonian phrase, was not in reference to the Establishment Clause, but it was in reference to the Free Exercise Clause. In other words, the court in 1878 took that phrase and applied it to the Free Exercise Clause, the latter part of the First Amendment, but not the former part. So the first thing that's very suspicious about this, in terms of what the court did in 1962 and 1963 through the Engle and Schemp cases, is they read words into the document that are not there. The second thing that's very suspicious concerning what they did, and this takes us to number two, is they took Thomas Jefferson's phrase and they yanked it completely out of context. Thomas Jefferson himself did not oppose Christian principles in public life. Neither did the founding fathers. They had no problem with the generic trans-denominational principles coming into public life and they were very much in favor of Christianity in public life. They were in favor of Christianity in the public schools. They just were against a denominational form of Christianity. So Thomas Jefferson did a lot of interesting things. He supported legislation where a minister and missionary would go to the Indians, supported by public money. Here's what Mansfield says. Mansfield's a very good historian that talks about these types of issues. He says, it was Jefferson, after all, who approved funds for evangelizing the Native Americans. It was Jefferson who attended church on federal property for most of his administration. He also approved still of other churches on federal property, and he even ordered the Marine Band to play in his church. Now, that really doesn't sound like someone who's committed to separating Christianity from public life. Now, you'll also remember that Thomas Jefferson was the author of the Declaration of Independence. The Declaration of Independence was signed in 1776, and Thomas Jefferson, the primary author of the Declaration of Independence, was not opposed to Christian-type or religious-type expressions in public life, because look at all of these religious terms that appear in the Declaration of Independence. The laws of nature and nature's God. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. They are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, appealing to the supreme judge of the world for the rectitude of our intentions, and then he says, with a firm reliance on protection of divine providence. Now, when I was going through school, people always told me, oh, those are just deist-type expressions. And I'm really convinced, and I provide some documentation in the book about that, that these expressions really aren't deistic in tone, they're biblical in tone. And we don't have time to go into all of that. But the fact of the matter is, the court relied upon this Jeffersonian letter, and yet they took Jefferson's words out of context because his own actions demonstrated that he did not oppose Christian principles in public life. Assuring simply that the Danbury Baptists would not have their religion interfered with, when Thomas Jefferson used this expression, separation between church and state, the only thing he was telling that group is, don't worry, the government is not going to try to regulate you in any sense. This is what the letter that Thomas Jefferson sent to the Danbury Baptists actually says. It says, believing with you that religion is a matter which lies solely between a man and his God, that he owes an account to none other for his faith or his worship, and the legislative powers of government reach the actions only and not opinions, I contemplate with sovereign reverence the act of the whole American people, which I declared that their legislature should make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof, thus building a separation between church and state. When Jefferson used the phrase, he was applying it not to the establishment side of the First Amendment, but to the free exercise side of the First Amendment. He was simply assuring these Baptists that, don't worry, the government is not going to interfere in any way with how you practice your Christianity. So what you can see here in point number two is when the court in 1962 and 1963 used Jefferson's phrase, they took Thomas Jefferson completely out of context. A, Jefferson had no problem with the generic principles of Christianity being expressed in public life. And B, when Jefferson used the phrase, he was applying it to the free exercise side of the equation, not the establishment side of the equation. Number three, here's a third reason, or a third problem with the modern judicial use of separation between church and state. Number three, the court ignored, in 1962 and 1963, they ignored the legislative activities of those who authored the First Amendment. The founding fathers never opposed public expressions of Christianity in government. Now, one of the things you can do to figure out what a piece of legislation means is to look at what that same legislature who passed that piece of legislation does. What do they do after the legislation is passed, and what have they done before the legislation has passed? The first Congress made up of those who adopted the Constitution just a couple of years later, passed what we call the Northwest Ordinance. And this is what the Northwest Ordinance says: religion, morality, and knowledge being necessary to good government and the happiness of mankind, schools and the means of education shall forever be encouraged. So the founding fathers that had accepted, ratified, adopted, and debated our Constitution, including the First Amendment, a few years later in 1789, they pass a piece of legislation where they're saying, heck, schools is the proper place to inculcate values and morality. So obviously our founding fathers would have had no problem with the generic principles of Christianity being expressed in public life. They thought schools and educational facilities was the proper venue, in fact, for the dissemination of those principles. The very people that came up with our Constitution were also very much involved with the War of Independence. And you may know about the Liberty Bell. You may know about the crack in the Liberty Bell. Some of you may have actually gone and seen the Liberty Bell. But what's interesting is on the Liberty Bell itself is Leviticus chapter 25, verse 10, a piece of scripture. It says, "And you shall forever consecrate the 50th year and proclaim liberty throughout all the land to its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee for you, and each of you shall return to his possessions, and each of you shall return to his family." So if our founding fathers wanted to completely vacate Christianity from the public square, they probably wouldn't have put a piece of scripture on the Liberty Bell itself. They wouldn't have accepted that practice. They certainly would not have passed the Northwest Ordinance, which I talked about just a moment ago. So the first Congress, the very Congress that accepted the Constitution, violated, supposedly, the very principle that they had enshrined in the Constitution. And that's the problem with the secularist position. The secularist is saying that the founding fathers laid down this principle of a strict wall between separation of church and state, and then they violated their own principle. And then it took 200 years for us to figure out what the founding fathers actually meant. And we see how crazy this becomes. So what has emerged is a case called Lemon versus Kurtzman, 1971, where our judges and our lawyers, our judiciary, has developed a three-pronged approach for figuring out these church-state type cases. Can you teach scientific creationism in the classroom alongside evolution? It has to satisfy a three-part test. Can you put a manger on the city steps of City Hall? It has to meet a three-part test. Can I have a Bible or prayer group in the public schools? It has to meet a three-part test. The activity must have a secular purpose. The activity must not advance nor inhibit religion. And then the activity must not excessively entangle government with religion. And that has been the three-part test that has been used ever since 1971. Dr. John Eidsmo, who's a conservative scholar that I appreciate and I quote a lot in that book, says, here's a better test. If you're interested in what the founding fathers actually meant, here's a better test. The activity is constitutional if it does not compel attendance at a religious service or activities. The activity is constitutional if it prefers, actually it's unconstitutional, if it prefers a particular church or denomination above all others. The activity is unconstitutional if it penalizes those who do not support a specific involvement with religion, such as by depriving them of the right to vote or to hold office. So this three-part test that's used is completely out of harmony with the vision of the Founding Fathers. And people have proposed a better test that is more consistent with the values of the Founding Fathers. But of course, this is not the test that's used. It's the Lemon test. So here we are on our list. We're taking a look at 9 problems associated with the modern judicial use of separation between church and state. Number 1, the court in 1962 and 1963 read words into the First Amendment that simply aren't there. Number 2, the court relied upon and took out of context a letter written by Thomas Jefferson more than a decade after the Constitution was created. And number 3, the court ignored the legislative activities of those who authored the First Amendment. Let's go to a 4th point. The 4th point is this. The court applied the First Amendment to the states in spite of the fact that the First Amendment is only a limitation on federal power. Now, I need to do a little bit of explaining here if I can. The system of government that we live in the United States of America is called federalism. Federalism is the idea that we don't just have one national government or one layer of government. We actually have 2 layers of government. We have the federal level of government, and then each individual state has its own realm of government. And when you factor in localities and municipalities and counties, you could argue that we actually have 3, 4, or 5 levels of government. Now, why in the world, when our founding fathers came to this country and set up our government, why did they give us at least 2 levels of government? Why did they give us a national government, and they also gave the states the governmental power? By the way, the 10th Amendment says those powers not reserved to the federal government are reserved for the what? The states. And if you look at what the Founding Fathers said, they said the powers of the federal government are few and defined, whereas the powers of the state government are numerous. Now, this may seem like a very strange way to set up a government. Why in the world did they set up government this way? No businessman or businesswoman would set up their business this way. This is a very inefficient way of doing things. And the answer relates to what our forebears believed about human nature. Because they were steeped in a biblical worldview, they had a particular doctrine of man. The doctrine of man is what we call anthropology, the study of man. Anthropos means man, ology means the study of. So we're trying to figure out what does the Bible teach about man. And when you read the Bible from cover to cover, what you discover is man is a sinner from the point of conception. And our founding fathers understood this. And so this is what they wrote in the Federalist Papers. The Federalist Papers were written by Hamilton, Madison, and Jay. They were published in the New York newspapers. And they were trying to get the New Yorkers to ratify the Constitution. And they explain a lot of why they did what they did in the Federalist Papers. So Federalist Paper number 51 lays it out on the line. It says, "What is government but the greatest of all reflections of human nature? If men were angels, no government would be necessary. If angels were to govern men, neither external nor internal controls on government would be necessary. In framing a government which is to be administered by men over men, the great difficulty lies in this. You must first enable the government to control the governed, and in the next place, oblige it to control itself." So the Founding Fathers said, we've got a little problem here. It's called sin. And sin has contaminated every member of the human race. Therefore, those that are under the government are sinners, and those that run the government are sinners. So we have to create a government that is strong enough to deter the population from sinful activity through the threat of punishment. But at the same time, we have to make the government weak enough so it does not corrupt those who are running the government, and they won't use it as an instrument of persecution. So the whole issue here relates to sin, and the Founding Fathers simply said, we've got to divide power up. Now, if you don't have a biblical worldview or a biblical anthropology, if you do not believe in the fallenness of people, then this concept of dividing political power up makes absolutely no sense. But if you're a biblicist who understands what the Bible reveals about man, you know that power has to be divided up, because as Lord Acton said, power corrupts and absolute power what? corrupts absolutely. So we've got to make the government strong enough to control sin, but weak enough to not go to the heads of those who are running the government. And this is the whole logic of the division of powers. So our founding fathers divided things up, first of all, horizontally. They created in the national government not just one branch of government, but three. And they created a system where those branches could check and balance each other. In other words, fight amongst each other. And consequently, this is how power has been divided up. They have a legislative branch, an executive branch, a judicial branch. By the way, those three branches of government, you'll find them right there in Isaiah 33, verse 22. For the Lord is our judge, that's judicial power. For the Lord is our lawgiver, that is legislative power. The Lord is our king, that is executive power. And so the three branches of government are there, and the founding fathers said, these are the three branches of government that we will divide up according to at the national level. But the founding fathers didn't stop there. They divided power not only horizontally, but they divided power vertically. In other words, they're going to say, we're not going to have just one government, we're going to have two. We're going to have a national government and multiple state governments. Here is Mansfield again. He says, when the founding generation of Americans turned to the business of creating a government, they had just fought a war against a centralized and controlling government. They had no intention of creating an American version of the same evil. And so the First Amendment then, as you study it, applies only to the national government. It has absolutely nothing to do with state government. Look at what the First Amendment says. Congress, see the word there? Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof. John Marshall, who was our third Supreme Court Chief Justice, said this in a case called Barron versus Baltimore. The Constitution was ordained and established by the people of the United States for themselves, for their own government, and not for the government of the individual states. Therefore, the Bill of Rights, that would be the first 10 amendments to the Constitution, contains no expression indicating an intention to apply them to state governments. So what happened in 1962 and 1963 in the Engel and Shemp cases is the court not only read words into the First Amendment that are not there, but they violated the will of the founding fathers by making those words applicable to what was happening in New York, which was a state school district, state-financed school district. Now, how in the world did the Supreme Court do that? How could they violate the First Amendment? Well, they used something called the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment was passed about 1868. The 14th Amendment was designed to give rights to recently emancipated slaves. Now, the 14th Amendment does apply to the state level. In fact, I have underlined there all the references to state or states within the 14th Amendment. And so the court started to use what's called the Due Process Clause. It says there in the 14th Amendment, all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are citizens of the United States and of the state wherein they reside. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunities of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law. So the court used this language, the due process clause, due process of law, and they began to pursue a practice called incorporation. And what that means is they used the due process clause of the 14th Amendment as a tool for making the Bill of Rights, particularly the First Amendment, which was never designed to apply to state governments, and they started making those things in the Bill of Rights applicable to the state level of government. Now, there was a case which happened in 1947 called Everson versus Board of Education, which set the table for what the court would begin to do in 1962 and 1963. This case involved a New Jersey law which authorized payment by school boards of the cost of transportation to and from school, including to parents who sent their kids to private schools, including parents who sent their kids to Catholic schools. The court upheld that arrangement, but they introduced in 1947 sweeping language, language which had never been brought into a Supreme Court opinion. And the language involved separation of church and state, never before applied to the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment, and they made the First Amendment and its restrictions applicable to the states. And so that language is on the books in 1947. I believe that language laid the foundation for what the Engle and Shemp courts would do in 1962 and 1963. Here's the language in the Everson decision. It says, in the words of Jefferson, the clause against establishment of religion by law was intended to erect a wall of separation between church and state. The First Amendment has erected a wall between church and state. The wall must be kept high and impregnable. We would not approve the slightest breach. Now, this language kind of went unnoticed because the court upheld the New Jersey statute. But this language is sweeping. And it's sweeping for two reasons. Number one, suddenly the phrase separation of church and state is applied to the Establishment Clause. And suddenly, with a whim of the court, with a stroke of a pen, the First Amendment is now applicable to the states. Now, the Founding Fathers never envisioned this. Now, why was this decision given? There was a man named Justice Hugo Black that you need to be aware of. He's the one who authored this decision. He was challenged on the basis of being a competent jurist. And this is what Mansfield says. His opinions sounded like Senate speeches and were unevenly reasoned. Justice Harlan Fiske Stone complained openly about Black to members of the press and even wrote Felix Frankfurter at Harvard Law School suggesting that Black be given some needed tutoring. Something else to understand about Black, Hugo Black, is in his background, he had Klan in his background. He was a former Klansman. Now, who does the Klan hate? They basically hate three groups of people. Number one, blacks. Number two, Jews. And number three, Roman Catholics. Now, this Everson decision dealt with money going to Roman Catholic parents. And that may explain the sweeping language found into a Supreme Court opinion in 1947. I don't completely know what Black's motives were, but I know that his record is such that he has been challenged not only in terms of competence, and also he has been challenged in terms of racism. But whatever his motives were, 1947, this language enters the judicial system for the very first time, and now I believe the foundation has been laid for what the Supreme Court would ultimately do in 1962 and 1963, use this concept of separation between church and state to ban Christendom. There is a fifth, and with this we'll finish this session, there's a fifth item that the Supreme Court engaged in. They, number five, ignored the original intent of the 14th Amendment. The context of the 14th Amendment has absolutely nothing to do with religion. The Engle and Shemp decisions use the due process clause of the 14th Amendment, yet the 14th Amendment in context has to do with the rights of recently emancipated slaves. In fact, there was something called the Blaine Amendment, authored by Representative Blaine from Maine, 7 years after the First Amendment had been adopted. And the amendment basically said this: we want to make the First Amendment applicable to the states through the 14th Amendment. And the very Congress that had adopted, debated, and ratified the 14th Amendment said no. In fact, this is brought up much later by a judge, Justice Learned Hand, in a case in 1983 called Wallace versus Jaffrey, and he says the Blaine Amendment's defeat was a stark testimony to the fact that the adopters of the 14th Amendment never intended to incorporate the Establishment Clause of the First Amendment against the states. So the court in 1962 and 1963 completely ignored the original intent of the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment historically has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with the rights of recently emancipated slaves. And those who had debated, adopted, written, and accepted the 14th Amendment, specifically through the Blaine Amendment, rejected this idea that the First Amendment could be made applicable to the states through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. I know this sounds like a lot of legalese, but it takes me a little while to go into the details so we all get a clear understanding of exactly what happened. 9 problems with the modern judicial use of separation between church and state. Number 1, the court read words into the First Amendment that simply aren't there. Number 2, the court relied upon and took out of context a letter written by Thomas Jefferson more than a decade after the Constitution was created. Number 3, the court ignored the legislative activities of those who authored the First Amendment. Number 4, the court applied the First Amendment to the states in spite of the fact that the First Amendment describes itself only as a limitation on federal power. And number 5, the court ignored the original intent of the 14th Amendment. Pretty depressing, but cheer up. It's about to get worse as I give you the final 4 points when we start our main service in the hour that follows. Father, we're thankful for a church like this that wants to learn about not just how the Bible relates to ourselves, but how it relates to society. I pray, Lord, that you would give us a greater understanding of these things so that we can be wise and discerning in the corrupt and fallen world which we find ourselves. And we will be careful to give you all the praise and the glory. And God's people said, Amen.